Hi, and welcome to this week's episode of the VFX show, where we are going back to June part two. An incredible film, a film that won the visual effects Oscars first time out. And I'm joined, as we like to be always, but wasn't able to be last time, by Jason Diamond. How are you, Jason?
I miss you all terribly whilst stuffing my face full of barbecue and 10 movies at South by Southwest.
Okay, I'm going to come back and quiz you on that real quick. And Matt, how are you?
I'm great.
So, yes. So last week we did a show without you, which we missed you. But yes, you said you were at South by Southwest. Well, how was it? And did you see anything interesting there that you can quickly tell us about before we get into June?
Yeah. I saw, like I said, 10 movies. Actually ended up seeing a lot of documentaries, which were fantastic. Managed to get into the Fall Guy trailer. Fall Guy premiere through a generous friend, and I can report as an early review that it is phenomenal. It is a love letter to movies, much like other films we've talked about have been, but this one specifically related to stunts in the Hooper genre of kind of super fun, very engaging, very good script for that type of movie. So I look forward to lots of visual effects in a fun way. So I look, definitely we should do that show.
Well, of course, it was shot here in Sydney. So we were watching Ryan skating across the Sydney Harbour Bridge and doing all sorts of things. So
I also saw a feature Australian film, first time feature directors, film called Bird Eater, which I highly recommend. And especially because their sort of point of reference was Wake and Fright, which is a classic piece of Australian cinema from the 70s with a younger Donald Pleasance and one of my favorites. And they certainly nailed the crazy tone of that movie.
You have an encyclopedic knowledge of cinema, my friend.
I try.
And so it was good generally, like the whole thing, like the tech stuff?
Yeah, it was fun. My brother and I did our mentor sessions, which we love to do and have been doing at the festival for almost 10 years, minus the pandemic. I talked virtual production. My brother did VR, met some great other mentors that I didn't know and other ones that I already knew. And and we also actually went to see the Daniels give their keynote about how we pulled off Everything Everywhere All at Once, which ultimately was not about that, because they're like, we've given that talk a million times. And I'll give you the link to their the keynote we went to. We can put it in the notes. It's on YouTube now. It's a must watch. They do it as they are wont to do. They do a very good job of balancing the concepts of filmmaking and or your goals in life with healthy approaches and sort of understanding empathetically your world around you and how to not be an asshole, which I think they do incredibly well. And very excited that last year they won 7 out of 11 Oscars. I think it was well-deserved for multiple reasons, also to see good people getting awarded for good things.
Very cool.
Yeah, that's my South by wrap up on top of lots of barbecue.
Yeah. In addition to South by Southwest, we've just had GTC and GDC, yep. Which I always find confusing to happen at the same time. Maybe I'm just dyslexic, but really interesting stuff coming out of NVIDIA, which I was super interested to see. And then amazing stuff just this morning, my time, coming out of the Epic presentation at GDC with more additional stuff with their metahumans and a bunch of other tech stuff. So it's been a busy time. Have you been tracking these things, Matt?
A little bit. I've been a little busy the last couple of days. I just recorded the first episode of what I'm calling season 2 of 8111, where I have a 2-hour and 10-minute talk with Steven Rosenbaum about his career, who I know you just talked to, Mike. And we talk about Masters of the Air, but also about like his 2 Oscars and his extraordinary career. So it's been a busy turnaround in the last couple of days. But yeah, I've been sort of, I see the headlines, but I haven't really dug in yet to see what's going on there.
So as we said in the Masters of the Air last time we spoke, Steven's a terrifically talented guy, and just the film, the whole show is great. So I'm really looking forward to listening to that, Matt. So that'll be brilliant. But let's swing our attention back to June 2. This is one of the most sort of anticipated films for me, a film I've really just been looking forward to enormously. Though I have to say, and spoiler alert, at the very end of the film, I was like, sorry, is there a June 3 that I don't know about? Like, I thought this was, you know, what happened? So what's your reaction, Jason, when you saw the film? And by the way, did you have the same reaction? Like, hang on a second, what? There's a part 3 I don't know about? Or did you feel like it wrapped up?
Second part first, I will answer that I had already heard the concept that he wanted to make a trilogy and that Dune Messiah would be the third kind of, I don't know if it's all of Dune had been wrapped up in the first two movies, but sort of the tail of that plus Dune Messiah would be movie 3. So I was kind of, I wasn't expecting it to be a cliffhanger, but certainly I kind of had maybe more than you, a little more information about where it's going to go for his trilogy. I also highly excited to see this, so much so that I went to see it IMAX with a friend at 11 p.m. Sunday opening weekend. So I got home at like 3 something in the morning because I could not go into Monday having not seen it of opening weekend for multiple reasons, especially my movie friend group berating me with spoilers that I would have to avoid. So I mean, if you want my full review, I loved it. I think overall, it is one of the greatest science fiction movies that we've had. Maybe not fully plot-wise, but certainly visual effects, cinematography. Frasier, as always, knocks it out of the fucking park. And
we love him.
The ship design, we can get into all this, but the ship design, the looks of things, the mix of practical and visual effects, I think were phenomenal. And the tone and the vibe of it, I mean, it's like a Starlog magazine from, like, you know, or something like that, you know, from the late 70s. You know, certainly Jodorowsky's Dune plays heavily in this. It feels like in the 70s vibe of a lot of the ship design and stuff, you know. But yeah, I loved it.
So Matt, were you House Andres, or are you with the Emperor on this one?
So, I mean, I'll confess I've shared this with my son and with some of my students this semester, like, because they all ask me what did you think of Dune? And I'm pot calling kettle black here. I'm kind of a weirdo, right? When all my friends when I was a kid in Southern California were reading the Lord of the Rings movie books and the Hobbit books and stuff, or the Hobbit book and the Lord of the Rings books, I found myself less interested in those. And as a kid, I was reading Dune and Dune Messiah and Children of Dune. Like, I was super into those books. And, you know, I will concur with Jason, like, you know, not to sound hyperbolic or anything, but I think if you look at Dune Part 1 and Dune Part 2, and I so hope they make Dune Messiah, I just started rereading it just after watching the second movie. But I would agree. I think this is those two films back to back, like as a, you know, bookends of one narrative. I think it's not hyperbolic to say that it's the best science fiction movie of at least the last 15 years, like all in, like in terms of every element of story, of casting, which I think the casting mm-hmm. is just aces throughout this whole thing. Casting, you know, cinematography, the world building, the design aesthetic, like all the great, there's some great George mm-hmm. Hull designs in there. I might be biased. I really like George. He's a great guy. But all the taste making, the Villeneuve, his his aesthetic sensibility, his taste in how he chooses to compose the shots and the sequence and in the edit, the way they let the story kind of roll out and unfold. There's a few things that I think are tricky with this, where they do have to rush a few things. They add a few things in these kind of dream narratives. And there are, I will say, two visual effect shots that I had problems with in the show. But I think overall, you know, it's, I immediately bought my copy of the digital one, pre-ordered it. You know, I paid my $30 or whatever. I can't wait to see it again. I really, really liked it. It was, it felt like I was, yeah, I felt like I was in on another planet, and it was a really great cinematic journey.
So the story of like, somebody coming from another planet down, and then there being environmental havoc wreaked, and then them realizing that instead of being part of a new solution, that they're actually part of a problem, and flipping over, and then becoming one of the... Oh, wait, hang on a second. I'm discussing Avatar now, aren't I? Not June. Wait a second. But then that person becomes the white messiah hero for that, and yeah, leads them in a battle against the technology with a more
sort of
like environmentally... Oh, wait, I'm still talking about Avatar. No, wait. Well, what was this film again? Oh, June 2, right, yeah. And so in that, there is a big fight sequence at the end, and it results... No, are we still on Avatar? I don't know. The thing for me, right, is that only because the books came out first do you realize how much modern cinema has mined the conceptual elements of Dune. And then when you see this, it is possible, if you didn't think about that or didn't know that, to actually think that you were watching something that was derivative.
Absolutely.
Not realizing that this is the source of all other, you know, sort of things that have sprouted from it. And so it's like absolutely the case that you could argue that Avatar is a remake of Dune on a planet full of water instead of a planet full of...
I mean, so Star Wars.
Yeah.
Star Wars is Dune mixed with the Hidden Fortress. I mean, straight up.
I don't know. The white messiah coming in to rescue the natives and then becoming...
No, that's Lawrence of Arabia.
I think there's a piece, though, that's really important, a couple pieces that are important to think about when, like, that is the popular narrative, the one that you're sharing, Mike, and I think that's a totally legitimate and absolutely 100% fair reading of it. But the thing I think that's important to keep in mind with, at least with Frank Herbert, you know, in terms of the writing of the book, you know, he was synthesizing all kinds of world historical events, thinking about religious iconography, religious dogma, and using a lot of those things along with a lot of psilocybin mushrooms, no joke, which is also kind of interesting. There's a psychedelic component to the writing of the book, but I think a fairly intellectual psychedelic component. And I think the thing that's so interesting to me about the Dune narrative, which I'm so glad that that's in this one, because it's really absent from the Lynch version, which is this thing, I think I might've talked about this before when we talked about Dune 1, but it's that, you know, Paul and Jessica, his mother, they recognize the power of myth, right? And the power of these religious myths. And the he's not the white savior. He's not Jesus, you know, like he's not that thing, like, or at least not in the contextual way in which I think many people think about those things in our world. He is... and his mother, they are people who recognize the power of story as a means to ascend to power, right? And they use it cynically, I think, actually, and actually more cynically in Dune Part 2, as a way to capture control of the universe in this story, which I think is one of the things that's exciting about it.
I would argue that Lady Jessica is the more... sort of controlling hand in the way you're describing it, of the really understanding, because she's been planning this since before Paul was born.
She understands the
Bene Gesserit and all this stuff. So she intentionally had a boy, like she, you know, because the Bene Gesserit can manipulate the baby and all this stuff. Paul is halfway there. Like, because he has the dreams, he doesn't understand as much that he has the Bene Gesserit kind of vibes in his brain. So he's fighting halfway.
But I think he comes to believe it. He says in this film,
at the end, he does.
Yeah, he says people believe what they're told to believe. Exactly. Whatever, right? Like, well, so he recognizes
rebelling as a teenager also, right? Like,
yeah, and she's much more Machiavellian in her endeavors, but but after he drinks the worm juice, I think can see there is that metaphysical piece that is also kind of the psychedelic piece, where once he becomes capable of seeing both the past and the future through the whatever it's the water of life or whatever, once he has that ability, then I think his transformation, it happens quickly in the film, which I think is a little tough, but I also think it follows very closely along the lines of the narrative was written, I think, in the book.
Yeah, I was just going to add one thing. Baja Blast is very powerful, so don't discount the blue liquid. But also, I did a deep dive on Frank Herbert after this because I have not read the books, and I do want to read them. Is that prior to writing Dune, because Frank Herbert obviously was born earlier in the century, 1900s. He, prior to writing Dune, was incredibly influenced by the stories of T.S. Lawrence. So not watching the movie, but hearing of Lawrence's exploits in the desert with the Arabs and oil and all that was a huge influence on him. So when I said Lawrence of Arabia before, it was actually, you know, prior to the cinematic version of that. But that was his, I think, to your point and Mike's point, that is a bit of the white savior kind of shit he was picking up on, whether he... I kind of agree with you, Matt. I don't think he's positioning it that way, but it's a clear path from.
Well, and it's important. I mean, we don't know this yet because they haven't made this film. I haven't heard that there's even a deal to make Dune Messiah, but Dune Messiah is not a narrative that suggests the ascendancy of the white savior is something that is positive, right? Like, it's a real deconstruction of a lot of those archetypal concepts and notions around myth and religious fervor and stuff in a way. It's sort of a deconstruction of all those things in a way that is actually pretty bleak, I think, in that larger narrative, which I think is kind of appropriate given some of the nature of the times in which we find ourselves today. It's an appropriate narrative.
So having not read the books, I found it really interesting to think of it through the lens of the Middle East and what Jason was referring to. Like, I found that more interesting than spending time pondering Avatar. I was more doing that as a joke. But that whole idea of like coming in and mining beneath the sands for oil and those sort of metaphors of, and then how you have different cultures responding to those myths and how different cultures respond to technology and a whole lot of other stuff. I found that really, really fascinating. And obviously there are quite strong sort of senses of an Arabian sort of overtone of, you know, costumes and a whole lot of stuff.
Score, clearly, yeah.
Yeah, so there's a whole lot of stuff there that makes it super interesting. I will say this, I haven't read the books, but I then was, when I got back and I was like, oh my God, they must be making a third film. And apparently he is working on the third film, so you can relax, man.
Really? Cool.
But the third film would be based on the book, and the book that came after the original Dune book picks up the story like 5 years later and is actually, from my understanding, not much of an action type of a piece. So I don't know, maybe you can eliminate us on this, Matt, but it struck the person that I was reading, like that, I think it was Hollywood Reporter, that it's a real challenge for the filmmaker, having made such an action piece in the second film, because the third one is much more a dialogue driven political analysis.
It's very Game of Thrones, or House of Cards or something.
Well, it's an arc, though, right?
Yeah.
Well, it could be an arc, but I mean, you know, at the end of the second film, there are a whole lot of ships going off to a battle, basically, right? Like, it's setting you up for, oh my God, there's going to be a huge space battle, and then the film ends, right? Now, I will say that, and having not read the books, I was not convinced that Paul had turned as you described. I was waiting for him to be like, I'm just doing this as a stunt, and he was going to run over to Zendaya and kind of give her a nod and a wink, and it's fine, hon, I'm just pulling this stunt because I need to. So I'm not 100%. I love everything about this film, but that one aspect of it felt to me like a sort of either deliberately ambiguous or an unresolved kind of change of intent in the character. So, but what, I mean, do you think that the Messiah book would make a good third film, or is it?
I mean, I think it would, but like, I don't know that I don't know that I'm like the prime target audience. Like, you know, I like heavy dialogue driven cinema, you know, that's like, you know, cerebral kind of storytelling. Like, I mean, I love action movies too, but I do like that kind of, like the slow.
Zendaya's character is much bigger grind. In Dune 2 than she was in the book, right?
Yeah, yeah. Well, no, she's actually a huge part of the book, and she's a big part of Dune Messiah too. You know, as the real true love of Paul, and in Dune Messiah of the Emperor, she is, I mean, spoiler alert for Dune Messiah, but she is controlled by the Bene Gesserit, who, one of whom, the Emperor's daughter, who Paul marries.
Irulan.
Yeah, she's the she's also a Bene Gesserit, as is Paul, the only male Bene Gesserit in a sense. And they, not Paul, but the Bene Gesserit, are conspiring to prevent Chani from giving birth and having an heir to the throne of the Emperor. And Paul is encouraged to have a child with the Emperor's daughter. Which I think is complicated, right? Because he has no interest in having a relationship with her, at least in the book, anyway.
So, and then, of course, in Dune 2, we have the Lea Seydoux character, Bene Gesserit, who leaves the encounter with Fade Rautha with the ability to bear his child, because they can manifest that kind of stuff, which otherwise would be impossible to know and have as a plot point, except for when you have space witches who can.
And Duncan Idaho, who was portrayed in the film, he is killed, but he returns as a kind of like a golem almost in Dune Messiah. And he's used to fool Paul, with the goal being to assassinate Paul as the Emperor. They're trying to kill him.
Interesting.
So it's kind of it's very Game of Thrones-ish, I think, as a narrative. Yeah, sorry. Huge spoiler alert.
Except for it's not a spoiler because we don't know actually what's going to happen at all, right? It could be a completely different story.
Yeah, they could totally change it, for sure.
And by the way, let's not discount the Bene Gesserit series that's going to be on Amazon soon that they already
have. Oh, that's a thing too?
Oh, yeah.
That's cool.
So
love those costumes.
All the costumes were on point. Epic. Like so much cool design. Like you said, all the way around, industrial design, costume design, world building design.
Although the original still suits, I think, were still better in the Lynch version.
You know, the thing that I, and we talked about this in Dune 1, and they do a better job of it in Lynch's Dune, although it's hokey, but it's cool, is they never really explain that the Third Stage Guild Navigators are basically cracked out in their space helmets on Spice. Totally. And because they can bend and fold time and space to allow interstellar time travel, thus being basically the universal traffic cops for the Emperor.
Well, right, and they so never they talk about CHOME, which is the organization under which the navigators exist. This is so cryptic and obscure. Like, it's weird that I know all this shit. But CHOME is also a way in which they refer to money and wealth and control and power.
I read the Wikipedia about Dune, but I find that so fascinating that's. I mean, obviously, there's so much to cram into this that, like you said, they have to leave stuff
it's
out.
Challenging.
Like, I haven't heard anyone talk about how, like, oh, I don't understand how they fold space. Like, they just have that big donut, hollow eclair that they kind of come out of. But like, you don't. The ships are so small because Villeneuve is really. I think we talked about this in the sort of ships leaving the water in Dune 1. Film for scale, like he is the master of scale. And I saw a thing earlier with him on Variety where he's like, I had a shot that I designed of a straight line with a dot on it. And he's referring to that wide shot of Paul when he's going to start to ride the worm or find the worm. And it's literally like a diagonal line and he's like a tiny dot. And like his ability to show scale and maintain the scale, which we all know is the super hard part, and we always talk about in like Godzilla and kaiju movies, is really hard to maintain based on your shot design and whatever. And I felt like that was super consistent in this, totally in this one.
But our listeners would kill me if I didn't go back and ask Matt, what are the two shots you didn't like?
Yes.
Oh, well, so there's just two shots that I now I keep in mind, I've only seen the movie one time. So it's possible. That's true too. But I mean that there could be some flaw in my initial viewing. But there's one shot that of an ornithopter that is, it's looking down. The camera's sort of like a God's eye view looking down on an ornithopter. And it takes place during the Harkonnen return to Arrakis during the beginning of the big battle. And the camera follows that ornithopter from above, and both the camera movement and the composite, for my money, like on that shot, I was just like, whoa, that looks like a temp. Like that does not look like a finished shot.
I totally agree. I was like, is that a test shot? What is that?
So you saw the same thing.
Yeah. And I was like, what? I didn't know what I was looking at. Like, it was almost like, is this like a, we're going to use, I don't know, a game engine for this shot, or are we going to do something different just to test it out for the third film?
The landscape of the dune, not the dune, the Arrakeen, whatever, where they live, the city that's been built by the Harkonnens, I guess, or whatever, the look of it, it just looked, it looked like a miniature kind of, or it looked like a model in a way that like it, nothing else looked like that. And I don't know if it was, I don't know if it was just the shot design. I don't know if it was the composite or there was like a missing layer of detritus in between or something. It just was
like
too.
They were using a different renderer. And I out loud in the cinema said to my wife, oh, that's not good. Like I didn't mean to say it.
I'm glad you saw it too. Like I thought maybe I'd had too much spice or something. I was like, what's going on?
It was an exceptionally odd shot to be in such a magnificent array of material that I was like, huh? Like initially I was like, I just couldn't, it took me out of the film, but also I tried to find some way to justify it being in the film. And we're about to have a pullback and this is on a monitor or a simulator or like, why am I saying this? Like,
part of what somebody think of is like this used to happen a lot when I was first working in the business, where like you'd have we talk about this all the time, but where there's a driving shot, and rather than have a compositor really do a well executed, you know, green screen shot in a car, they would just let the editor do it. And not to say that there aren't amazing editors who are great compositors too. I don't mean to suggest that's not the case, but I think a lot of times it was just cheaper and faster. And I felt like this was one where like they needed a shot that was some kind of connective tissue in the edit, right? And there was the thing that wasn't, there was something missing. And so they ripped this thing together quickly. And I don't know how they did it, but it didn't feel like it was a part of all the rest of the work. It really stood out.
Well, and I don't recall that shot. I'm definitely going to see it again. I saw it in regular IMAX, which is more widescreen, but I'm going to go see it at the Lincoln Square IMAX here, which is the largest actual IMAX screen in the country, and that will be the full top to bottom kind of frame. But having read some interviews with Fraser and some other people, I know for the ornithopter stuff that they often shot Blackhawks and other real choppers taking off, so that they could then composite, you know, paint out the chopper and put the ornithopter in. So you have the real dust and the real stuff. And
that's cool.
So, I mean, you know, to your point, there may have been in this particular case, a lack of those elements.
No Blackhawk. And if you want to know the only other shot that bothered me, it doesn't bother me from an effects execution standpoint. It bothered me from a shot design standpoint or an animation standpoint. And it sucks because
Can I guess what it is?
Yeah.
Well, finish what you're going to say about what sucks, but don't say what the shot is.
I thought it just sucked from a design standpoint and animation standpoint. And it's such a heroic moment in the movie, and the tail end of it just didn't quite click.
So maybe it's not the same shot I'm thinking about. I'm thinking more about
what were you thinking?
Well, I'm thinking about a more of a sequence. This overall design, which is when Lea Seydoux meets Fade Rautha in that dark H.R. Giger hall, that the way that it's intentionally lit dark so you can't see anything, but then you have lightning or other, you know, random light, outdoor lighting, creating, you know, lighting on the walls. It felt a little set-y to me. I like the
design. I didn't notice that, but.
Yeah, I like the design of it. But because you couldn't see a lot and you just caught things, like, you couldn't feel, like, everything else in the film has so much texture and so much, like, reality. And this felt a little bit like a set or even a comp, maybe.
I was going to say, like, that shot, I know that when you're talking about, it felt like stagey. It felt like it was theatrical, not necessarily bad theatrical, but like if I was seeing the best West End production of something and they designed it, that they'd go and you'd be like, that's really good. But in a film like this, it was like, a little kind of, theatrical. Hey,
But wait, Matt didn't say his shot because I interrupted.
Oh, what's the shot? Yeah.
So I didn't guess
so
it.
So just for the record, my son, he saw it yesterday, finally up in Boston where he's going to university. And he texted me today and he's like, guess who just saw Dune? You know, we chatted about it on the text for a while. And he said, what were the shots you didn't like? And I told him and he was like, I didn't notice that. He's like, and I said, it's the curse of being someone who worked in effects for a long time. I think is that there's just things that for whatever reason, sometimes will stick out to you. And so the other shot that bothered me, and it's a really heroic shot in the movie and it's incredibly successful. And this is a minor quibble and maybe it's just me. I'm sure there's other people.
Come on, what is it?
But when the worms emerge from the dust cloud and they come up, like coming up out of the sand and they're huge, like toothy, you know, orifices, their mouths or whatever are there. And it's like this dramatic moment. The music is swelling and they come down and they land on the ground and they land and they go, doo-doo. They both kind of go, boop, boop, you know, in this kind of goofy way that they've been moving through the sand. And now suddenly the sand is this hard, impermeable body and they bounce in this animation way. And it made them look so huge and epic in this majestic moment. And then they looked so tiny all of a sudden. And like, they looked like CG.
Is it because of the distance between the bounces? Like it should take a long time for it to bounce.
Yeah, right? It was almost like it was too fast. Like it betrayed scale. Like it was something that just it was a tiny thing. But I when I saw it, I was like, And so it just took me out of it for just a second, you know?
Yeah. Can I switch discussion now? Firstly, just pointing out, Austin Butler was in last week's Masters of the Air acting kind of obviously ensemble, and he's again in this and obviously been in Elvis. I thought after I saw him in Masters of Air, I was like, this guy is a movie star. There's just no two words about it, but he's just playing the same kind of character, right? And then I saw him in June and I was like, okay, now this guy can act, right? Like before that, he just seemed like, you know, like the way back in the day that Mel Gibson just always seemed a bit like Mel Gibson, whatever, what film he was in. And so I was feeling
that.
Like,
he's like, talk to me.
But when I saw him in this, I thought, okay, he's actually, he has assumed a new character in a way that you should, and not like, oh, that's what he's like in real life. And I imagine if I met him in the street, he'd just be like that. Now, to that end, then I'd love us to discuss, and Jason, particularly if I could get you to start on this, the monochrome sequence of the fight that Austin Butler's in, right?
Yeah.
Because this is interesting at so many levels to me, right? It's interesting in terms of the cinematography, which I love your opinion on, but also it's interesting as a conceptual thing. Like, does it actually work in the film that you can have light that is only monochromatic? Does it, and then how it was done, which in itself, just behind the scenes, is fascinating.
Yeah. Quickly on the Austin Butler thing, I thought in the very, very beginning of his intro into the film, Dune 2, it's almost like it was day one and he was like dropping the Elvis accent a little bit. It's like a little bit in there, but then his aping of Stellan Skarsgård's voice as a nephew to Baron Harkonnen was spot on. It was dope. And the fact that he makes Bautista look like a big pussy is amazing.
Isn't it?
Yeah. It's like, But also, that's kudos to Batista, right? Like, he gets a lot of shit for being a big kind of, you know, big giant wrestler guy, but the dude can act. Like, seen him act totally in Blade Runner and, you know, other, and certainly Guardians is his comedic side, but even in Blade Runner and other things, like even Knives Out, which the Second Glass Onion, while I didn't like the movie that much, it was great. I mean, everyone performed well in it. Anyway.
100%, yeah.
I loved the concept of the Black Sun that is, I don't know how, they don't explain it. They just say the Black Sun and then everything looks negative, basically. But the fact that they shot it, to your point about the way they did it, is instead of making it monochrome, it's infrared. And infrared, if anyone, for people who don't know, unlike monochrome, which is not capturing or in the process of, whether it's filming in digital, in digital, the sensors always capture luminance and those buckets are converted to RGB channels based on number of pixels. And if there's a color filter in front of the sensor or part of the sensor and all that stuff, and if you remove the color sensor, you get a monochrome, super sharp image. On film, my film knowledge is slim, but I'm assuming there's similar luminance processes happening with chemicals and whatever. So infrared is actually reducing the wavelengths of light to specific infrared nanometers. Mike, you can correct me. I think it's like 75 or 60 something nanometers. I could be wrong.
I can't give you the nanometers off my head, but it's of course responding also to heat, right?
Yes.
Because it's at that end of the spectrum.
Yeah. And so that's how you get that really white skin. Is you wouldn't be able to get that in monochrome because there would be shades of gray. And there it's not really a lot of gray in the infrared, that's how you get those kind of pearly skin tones. And certainly, like, you know, black skies or other things. And I think, as we've discussed on previous shows, certainly like Nope and Ad Astra, where Hoyt Van Hoytema has used the stereo rigs to use infrared to capture really high contrast luminance data to do this day for night stuff. I thought it was used expertly, especially as they do a little bit of the Wizard of Oz with the sepia painted Dorothy double when she opens the door to the color, and it feels like you're seeing, how did they transmission from black to white? Well, black and white to color. Well, they didn't really. But in this case, they have this split kind of walk out on the parapet, walking out the things where it's in color and it goes into infrared. I'm not entirely sure how they did that. It's probably just maybe a lock off split screen or motion control or something. But that, I think, was the most effective thing instead of just cutting to this really intense infrared / monochrome look, that you see that it's because of, like, again, Villeneuve's the master of not really telling you and just showing you. You see the shot design that's showing you, look, they're totally normal and they cross this threshold and, oh, clearly something is creating that. And then they have that, there's like one line about the Black Sun or something. I mean, also from a story point, just the fact that, you know, you're led to believe that Fade Routh is this super badass villain, but he's really fighting drugged, you know, fighters for sport to maintain his status. And he's never really actually in danger until he gets to Dr. Yue. But scale, you know, mixture of CG miniatures and just great shot design.
The triangular arena. And along the lines of what you're talking about with the IR stuff, just a quick shout out. When I first went to the Mars conference in 2019 and then again in 22, I met with this guy who was there, who had been attending. He's a imaging technologist and a former astrophysicist. He worked at FLIR, you know, who does all optics for all kinds of satellites and weapons and things like that. But he wrote a great book. He's a super nice guy, this guy, Austin Richards. And he does all kinds of infrared radiometry, optical gas imaging, hardware design, and image processing and stuff. And he wrote this really great, fairly inexpensive paperback book called Alien Vision, all about IR stuff and thermal imaging and stuff like that. And it's it's a thin book, but it's a great read. And he makes a lot of that kind of technology and that kind of invisible spectral representation really accessible to the layman. So if anybody's interested, Austin Richards' Alien Vision is a really cool book. And he's a super cool dude, lives out in Santa Barbara.
Can we confirm something? Oh, sorry, Mike, go ahead. And then I have a question.
I was just going to say, like, what I really liked about the infrared, and you touched on it, is the way that it makes the skin tones look. And so let me geek out for a second on that. Like, obviously, if you have somebody with a normal, without makeup on, you'll get a specular highlight. You'll say, oh, they look really, like, sweaty, or they look like they've got, you know, shiny spots on them. But if you think about, like, the sun falling across your face, it doesn't have a hot spot. You think that it has a hot spot when you look at a picture, but it doesn't have a hot spot. What it has is a point where the surface properties of your skin are just reflecting and it's not subsurface scattering. The rest of when it's off angle, is subsurface scattering. And so it looks diffused. Hence, you've got that diffused and specular highlight. Take away the specular highlight and you get this really, as you said, kind of mother of pearl.
Pearly, almost.
Look. What I think is really great about this is as much as I could just geek out on the tech of filming it that way, the point of these people is that they have a polluted society, a society that is not very healthy. And so when somebody's looking sick, you might say, oh, you need some sun, you're looking kind of pasty. And they would have those skin properties of like somebody that's like in Greek times, you do or Roman times, you do a marble sort of death mask kind of thing, right? And that that marble does the same sort of thing. So this idea in our society that someone's not very healthy if they are kind of pasty and need some sun and just don't have that kind of skin property, and their skin is, when it's older also, when your skin is older, it gets more transparent, and you'll notice that especially on the hands of really elderly people. And so what I'm saying here is, yes, the technique was cool. Yes, it looked funky and I think it was great, but also it's totally playing into the subtext of why these people are not to be applauded and not to be backed. And so the emotional subtext of them being the bad guys is just enhanced by the technology of the VFX / cinematography. And I think that's just where it just shines. It wasn't just a cool effect. It was
totally
a cool
in support of the story and the character and the world. Yeah, for sure. It's very well integrated in total into the every aspect of that universe, the world building. It feels directly connected to all that stuff.
So I want to ask Matt about that sequence, because you didn't pick it as one of the things you didn't like, and I liked it. But what did you think of the fireworks? The splatty, dome.
Yeah, that it's like almost like
invisible dome kind of firework.
Yeah, like a paint splatter kind of, or almost, it reminded me a little bit of the, what was the X-Men movie with the character who could like poof and like reappear?
Oh, Nightcrawler. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. It kind of had that same look to it.
Bamf,
which, is the although I actually think the Nightcrawler poof was a little cooler than this was in terms of the quality of the fidelity of the explosive, right? That was more like almost like a smoky powder. And this looked more like
paint.
Ink.
It looked like paint on the inside, ink on the inside of a bowl. Almost.
Yeah, or like balsamic falling into the olive oil or something, you know? Like it just didn't quite have that same like high frequency fidelity that, again, I think it would give it more scale. It had a little bit more of a rounded, but you know, did it bother me? No, like
you didn't.
It would have been fun to do more experimentation with it.
My only production design problem with these things, and it's common to every film like this, it was the same in Thor, Love and Thunder, right? It's like, I think Love and Thunder, it was the second Thor of the one before it. When you have a stadium and a fight, in that case, it was Thor versus Hulk, and here it's this insanely great battle, and you give the best seats in the house a million miles away up in the air, like you can't bloody see anything, right? And like, I feel like if you were actually kind of getting into realism of theater design, you do what they do in an English theater where they put, you know, a special box right next to the stage, right up the front at the side, so they get the best seats in the house. And the idea that you sort of like some level, you want to elevate them because they look like they're on a throne higher above everybody else, but they wouldn't be able to see a bloody thing. And there's no screen or, you know, kind of obvious reason why it would want to be there.
I think, though, to your point, in this particular case, and I will compare it also to Fury Road with the Immortan Joe kind of thing, is it's more of a, to the point you were making, the kind of minor point you were making, is it is more about an elevation of power than it is understanding or caring about
the
details of what's happening. It's
in
like,
the
hey,
cinematography, it works better to have them higher up because it's, you know, elevation of power. But like in some of the films that have depicted the fight in the Colosseum, you've got the Roman emperor not all the way at the back, but kind of halfway down near the front, where they could really see pretty well in the middle of the thing. And it kind of, and I think in the film Gladiator, that was where it was as well, sort of like in a plausible kind of place, right? But if you go to a cinema, or sorry, you go to a theater production, the cheap seats are the ones at the back high up, right? I mean, they're not the seats that are expensive are down the front where you can really see what's going on. And so I think if you were really wanting to excel at production design, you'd come up with a way of inverting that trope and have a kind of premiere position at the front, but still somehow elevated in, and that's beyond my production design capabilities to work out how you would do that, but you would have it, you know, that they are the be all and end all. And if you were the plebs, you'd be further back. And I just feel like in any of these, even in Star Wars Episode One, when they had the race, you know, the pod race, no one's going to see bloody anything because it's just, you're sitting there and you're like, I can't see anything.
I think in this particular case, I'm not saying you're wrong, but I will defer to the fact that the design was more focused on the elevation of power and not the more gladiator Joaquin Phoenix being like down and like seeing the blood splatter vibe.
I mean, you could just say they were so wide that at that wide angle, like everybody looks tiny, you know? So maybe
I mean, also you could argue, in a film that has this much visual complexity, why the hell am I talking about the position of an emperor or a ruler, you know. But if we get back to the earlier stuff that Matt was talking about, when we get to the feminine and when we get to both when they go south and before they go south, those sequences, now that has none of what I'm criticizing. That in every case seem to have a complete plausibility of staging. Like he walks in and when he's down south to the center of an area where there was clear delineation of how close you were to that stage. He was slightly raised up so you could see him. Everyone was bowing. Like there was like a lot of just innately correct kind of staging. And then the cinematography to capture that was beautiful in the camera angles, everything Matt was talking about earlier, right? Whether it was looking up or looking down, we weren't just sort of going there for the spectacle. It was an informed staging that was trying to communicate something at every level. So yeah, the feminine side, that was just the stuff I loved the most in terms of the visual effects and production design and for that matter, cinematography.
I think one of the hardest effects in it has to be the worm riding. Like, I think that's a big challenge. And I think they did a pretty good job. Like, I think the only part that's sort of vexing is like, it's so challenging for Paul to get on the big worm the first time. And he does it. And it's like, yeah, cool. He's the guy, you know, he's got the mojo. But then like they show all these like, you know, old people and, you know, a hungry
the
people
village.
Riding on the on the worm Uber across the desert, you know, and it's sort of a strange phenomena. Like, how do they get up there? Like, how does that work? Like, they don't really. So it's,
I imagine that if you've broken it, as in like breaking a horse, right? If you've like got control of it, then
yeah,
you can maneuver
it somehow.
Yeah,
that makes sense.
Again,
that's
it's
a bit
of a
end.
Skip, but I did have the same thing. It's like, if you could go with the wild Brumby kind of, if you know, the wild beast riding it and then it sort of settles down once you've got it. Because it's never explained why having a couple of hooks on its back on a beast that big causes you to be able to turn it left or right, you know? So there's some sense that
it's a community.
That was, I mean, that was much better handled, obviously, in things like Avatar, where there was a sort of direct thought of a cerebral kind of link. Anyway, we're running low on time, so I want to wrap this up. I do think the film is brilliant. I think Matt's got a couple more points that he just wants
to
make.
I just want to highlight two of the best effects moments in the movie for my money. There's one of a ship that is firing and it's making a pop, 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 pop sound, and it's firing on another thing on the ground and it blows it up. It's at night. It's so cool looking. And then I think the best effects sequence that really stood out in my mind, and it was so fun to watch because there was so much storyboarding that must have gone into and staging or previs or something, where it's where the big digger is down and Paul and Chani are like trying to plant explosives, but they're trying to hide from the gunfire that's coming from the ornithopter that's above them. And that sequence of the big legs moving and stuff was so cinematic and so well staged. And the effects in it, I thought, were really spectacular.
I was going to say that as one of mine. And that also I had read in one of the articles that that the rule on set or in production was, if it was something the actors could touch, it was built. So like when they're hiding behind that thing, that they built that.
That's a real leg.
Piece of something. You know, when he's riding the worm, that is a giant piece of the worm that he's touching. Like anything they can physically touch, they made. I think on top of what you're saying, I 1,000,000% loved the overall ship design and the whole construct of the final Emperor's valley that they settled in with the orb that had the fire coming off of it. Yeah. I mean, like, fuck.
So
that
cool.
I was like, oh my God. Like to Mike's point, I legitimately said out loud in the theater, like, oh my God, when they showed the kind of medium shot and the balloons kind of collapsed and you had that like pyramid city that was kind of silvery and draped there, and you had all the
imaginative stuff, and expansive.
It was so 70s though, like the silver, like phantasm ball, you know, hovering, and just the way that it had the flames with coming off of it, like for no reason other than it just looks dope. Like, and you could see it from the where they were fighting and the whole, you know, I don't know. I will say my overall, and it seems weird to say, my overall impression and sort of respect for this movie is the word restraint. There actually is a ton of restraint in this movie, which is why it works, to the point where in the final battle between Paul and Fade Rautha, it's mostly shot with them in the silhouette against the sort of Cylon eyes, you know, helmet window. And there's one shot, only one, and it's maybe 2 seconds where they flip the camera around and look back at them with that window at the camera's back, and you see all the people standing there watching, and it's a gorgeous shot, and they only use it once. And while I wish there was more of it because I thought it was a great shot, the impact of seeing it once was, I think, more valuable, and that is restraint. I mean, that is, you, this shit could go off the rails really fast if you just don't control yourself. And I feel like that's what we're watching.
Yeah. So in summary, we love the film and we love both of the films. We are out of time though. So Matt, where can people connect up with you if they want to follow and admire your encyclopedic knowledge of Dune?
Letterboxd, just as Matt Wallen. And you can find me at my website, mattwallen.com.
And Jason, if they want to check out your encyclopedic knowledge of film generally, especially of early Australian 70s cinema.
Anywhere you can type in the word Jason Diamond as one word.
Okay. Or the Diamond Bros. And of course, I'm Mike Seymour over at FX Guide. Guys, thanks so much for being here today. It was great. Really, really great. And I don't think I'll drink the worm juice, but I definitely would be hanging out for June 3 and the Messiah. Thanks so much, guys. Talk to you next time. Bye.
If you have any questions or comments, please email us at vfx@fxguide.com. Copyright FX Guide, LLC.